Hey everyone, before we get into today's conversation, I wanted to give you a quick disclaimer about it. Today we talked about changing the relationship that we have with food. And so I wanted to start by letting you know what we cover during this conversation and what we don't. This was explicitly not an episode about dieting or about nutrition or about weight loss. It was about changing our relationship with certain kinds of habit patterns that we've decided aren't working for us anymore. In this case, we're focusing on food-related habit patterns and particularly forms of emotional eating. I think the overall tone of today's conversation is very supportive, but nonetheless, just to state the obvious here, if these are sensitive issues for you, feel free to skip today's conversation. We will be back next week with a different episode on a different topic, and if this one's just not for you, hey, maybe just give it a pass. So here's our conversation with Dr. Jed Brewer. Hello and welcome to Being Well. I'm Forrest Hansen. If you're new to the show, thanks for joining us today. And if you've listened before, welcome back. Today, we're exploring a topic that I have been assiduously avoiding for the better part of 6 years here: food habits, emotional eating, and how we can form a healthier relationship with food. I'm joined by two guests. First, as usual, clinical psychologist Rick Hansen. So, Dad, how are you doing today?
I'm good and thoroughly psyched about this topic and, in particular, our guest.
I am also really looking forward to it. One of the reasons that we've been kind of avoiding this, or really I've been avoiding this, is that I just think it's so hard to get the conversations about these issues right. And a lot of the conversations that you see out in the space are really more harmful than helpful in a lot of ways. But we're joined today by a former two-time, now three-time podcast guest, I think that's the record, who is truly one of the world's leading experts on habits, Dr. Jed Brewer. So Jed, how are you doing today?
I'm good, and thanks for having me back.
Yeah, so happy to be doing this with you. If you are not already familiar with Dr. Jed, he's a psychiatrist, the director of research and innovation at Brown University's Mindfulness Center, a professor in behavioral and social sciences at the School of Public Health and Psychiatry at the School of Medicine at Brown University, and a research affiliate at MIT. He's also the best-selling author of a number of books, including The Craving Mind, Unwinding Anxiety, and his most recent book that we're going to be talking about today, The Hunger Habit, Why We Eat When We're Not Hungry and How to Stop.
Well, Jed, it's so great to be with you. A lot of levels. One thing I'm struck by is that we've had you on before and we've talked about your previous work on addiction and anxiety. And you ran a smoking cessation program back in the early 2000s. Gosh, that's 20-ish years ago. And it had a surprising finding. What was that surprising finding? And how is that relevant to our topic today?
Yeah, it's a great place to start. So this actually stemmed from some of my failure to help my patients in my clinic quit smoking, where, you know, in medical school, I'd learned all the willpower ways and these five A's that I can never remember, you know, ask, advise, assist, something, something. And I was trying to think of, you know, what was I missing here? And as a, you know, I'd been meditating for a while and had been exploring, you know, like, what if we just tried something radical where I just had my patients go ahead and smoke? Because they're going to do it anyway, right? And so they were smoking anyway. And so I sent them home with the explicit instructions to smoke. And they're, you know, they're walking out the door like, my doctor just told me to smoke, you know? But the further instruction there was to pay attention as they smoked. And that set off a series of studies culminating in a randomized controlled trial with basically helping people use mindfulness training to quit smoking. And the surprising finding there was that we got five times the quit rates of gold standard treatment. And the reason that that's relevant today is that that set off a series of chain of events. So the first was that it really suggested something radical in modern day, which is changing habits isn't about willpower, it's about awareness. And that, you know, that randomized controlled trial with very strong results suggested that that actually may work. And so that helped me start to look at like what's going on here mechanistically. The second thing that it set off was that we were looking at ways to scale that treatment. And so we'd started playing with digital therapeutics, you know, app-based mindfulness training programs. So we developed this Craving to Quit app and started having people pilot test it. And our pilot testers said something to me that I will never forget, where they said, oh, I'm changing my eating habits. And at first, I assumed that they were just eating as a way to substitute food for cigarettes, because that's typically what we see. In fact, it's like 15 pounds of weight gain is the average for somebody in the US when they quit smoking. So here I am making an assumption that they're just substituting food for cigarettes. Fortunately, they corrected me and said, no, that's not the case. We're actually applying these tools that you developed in this program to change our eating habits. And that was a huge aha moment for me, because I had never really looked at eating as a, you know, more than helping my patients in my clinic, but hadn't looked at it as a research endeavor. So started looking at the mechanism there, saw a shared mechanism, and then just dove in as, you know, as fast and as deep as I could to explore this, and then develop a program to see if we could actually apply the same methodology for eating.
So I want to ask you here, Judd, about all the things that you're not focusing on in this book, essentially all the stuff that this book is not about. This is not a diet book. It is not really a nutrition book. It is a book about habits, fundamentally. And like you were saying, how you are applying these tools that you've learned in your work on habits to a particular kind of challenge that people have. But I would also love to just like open up some space for you to talk about that, because I kind of, you know, vented about it in the intro to the episode a little bit. So what do you think about this?
Yes. So what I've seen, and I'm guessing you've seen the same thing, but correct me if I've wrong, or add something if I'm missing something. There is a ton of information out there around everything from what we should eat to, you know, not just macronutrients, but micronutrients now, you know, and gut health and all this, and calories and body types. And so there's all this cognitive information, at least at a population level, that says, oh, this is what you should eat, this is what you shouldn't eat. And to some degree, I learned that back in medical school, you know, breaks down to the basic formula of calories in, calories out, which is still taught in medical school today. So that is known. The other thing that is known is all the ways that companies engineer food-like products to be very addictive. And so I give a nod to these in the book just to highlight that this is a specific problem that has gotten people particularly hooked on food. But two reasons that I didn't write about that is, one, it's already been well-researched and documented, so I don't need to write those books. Fortunately, there are great books out there, like Michael Moss's book on food engineering, amazing. So I don't need to write about those things, but it's helpful to give a nod to that. But one reason that this, as a general category, highlights that information is not enough.
So we know it. There's no lack of the knowing. It's the actual doing. And your book is so much about motivation at bottom, right? And shifting from, we could say, pragmatically problematic motivations to ones that are more beneficial for the individual and perhaps ultimately even for the planet. So it's also clear that your book's not about a particular treatment for eating disorders like bulimia, anorexia, and so forth. And you're not going into, you know, how to lose those 10 pounds that you're really working on. So what is the problem with diet? So we have this major industry, if you will, that's really focused on helping people lose those 10 pounds or 30 or more. They have all these technologies, they have all these approaches. Billions of dollars involved. What's the problem?
Just knowing information doesn't change behavior. And so certainly knowledge can be helpful, like understanding a concept, but wisdom doesn't develop from knowledge. You need that critical intermediate step of experience. Without our direct experience, we're not going to change behavior. And so everybody's so focused in their head. And actually, this is a great business model for all these diet programs, because they can say, oh, well, the formula is correct. You didn't follow the formula. You should sign up for another year. So it's good for business. It's just not good for the individual, because it doesn't lead to lasting change. And on top of it, it fosters something that I think we've all seen way too much of, which is guilt and shame. So people feel guilty that they can't follow the particular diet, whatever the diet du jour is, And then they feel ashamed of themselves and feel like there's something wrong with them. And so one thing I just want to highlight loud and clear is that, you know, enough with this, there's something wrong with me. Let's, you know, let's let go of those old stories and usher in the truth, which is this is just our brain that's trying to help us survive. In modern day, people have been able to kind of miswire some of our key, you know, survival mechanisms to get us addicted or, you know, get us in habitual eating modes because food is readily available and it's, you know, comforting in many ways. And so what we can do is just rewire the brain in a way that is actually based on, you know, basic neuroscience principles. And, you know, my lab has studied this now for years and we've got pretty good results suggesting that that indeed is the case. I'll say two things. One is it's simple, but not necessarily easy. And the key here is trusting or relearning to trust the feeling body rather than the thinking brain.
To just kind of like jump on board some of the stuff that you're saying here, Jed, just my view, the proliferation of like diet culture in the Western world, particularly the United States, is like top five, top 10 negative mental health impacts on the largest number of people in my personal lifetime. I've seen friends struggle with this. I've seen partners struggle with this. I've seen most of these conversations just lead to an increase in anxiety, shame, self-disgust, as opposed to any availing of it. And so you've got a combination of factors that have led to a lot of suffering without a lot of help. Most of the research that we have on the topic shows that diets basically don't work for most people. What I mean by that is that when people lose weight, they lose a relatively small amount of weight and they lose it for a relatively short period of time. In part because the fundamental construction of how these things work, like you're saying, is just wrong. They're based on willpower. Again, as you explore in the book in some detail, the research on willpower has been a mixed bag at best over time. And you've really approached this through a very different lens, which is about kind of learning from what your body is telling you, as opposed to learning from what your brain has been conditioned to tell you by all of these various things, including, like you're saying, food engineering, which really tries to hack into what's going to be maximally addictive for your brain.
Absolutely. Well said.
Well, thank you. And I would love to ask you a little bit about that willpower element of it, like how, you know, a lot of traditional approaches here are about just don't do it. You know, it's very the inverse of Nike. And like, what have you found about that? And like, what are the problems with willpower?
Yeah. Well, and this is just summarizing quite a bit of literature that, like you're saying, is mixed at best. There was a whole, let's call it genre of research for a while called ego depletion research, where folks were taking this common sense idea that, you know, we can resist temptation early in the day and then we can't resist it later in the day, and therefore it must be because our ego is depleted. And there have been literally hundreds of studies done on this, and there was recently a meta-analysis that basically came out equivocal, saying about half the studies suggested that it might be true and about half said that it might not be. And when you look at that number of studies and where you're getting equivocal research, it suggests that it's actually a coin toss, that by chance, somebody could say yes, and by chance, somebody could say no, because this is more of a self-report. And if the science is suggesting that it's equivocal at best with all these numbers of studies, you know, at some point, you know, the game is over. If you look at it from a neuroscience perspective, so not a psychology, but a neuroscience perspective, the neuroscientists aren't even including willpower in the conversation, which is kind of interesting. And so as a neuroscientist, I want to know what is in the conversation. And there are actually some well-established formulas. The most well-known one was put forward in the 1970s by these two researchers, Roscorla and Wagner. So many people are familiar with Roscorla-Wagner curves because they are non-controversial, meaning that the basic formula is still the same. If you look at animal studies, if you look at human studies, they're not equivocal. They're showing pretty much the same results. And if you look at those, they highlight, it's actually a pretty simple formula, they highlight that we basically develop the reward value of a certain behavior. if we've done that for a while, we just set it aside as habit. We don't even pay attention to the reward value anymore. I think of it as set and forget. And that's actually a very helpful survival mechanism because it helps us do two things. One, it helps us not have to relearn everything that we did every day. And it also pragmatically helps us make decisions. So for example, if we've determined that we like, you know, a certain type of chocolate, like for me, it's dark chocolate over milk chocolate. I've made that determination. I could keep testing that, but it's actually now pretty straightforward for me. So I don't have to say, oh, given a choice, which type of chocolate do I buy at the store? So it's very efficient. And if you look at it that way, that helps us, you know, be efficient in life, but also provides this critical insight into how behaviors change. And this is very in line with what you both talk about a lot. The critical ingredient here is awareness. So bringing awareness in as we're doing a behavior. So let's say we scratch that itch of craving and we're in the middle of a behavior, we can actually learn a ton from that. And that's how behavior change happens. So I have set up in my mind a reward value hierarchy of chocolate. So for me, milk chocolate, low on the list, dark chocolate, anything above 70%, you know, I'm not going to slum it, you know, below 70, so to speak. And so, you know, like a new chocolate shop opens up in my neighborhood and I look in the window, it looks like they've got good chocolate. I can go in there and I can try their chocolate. And if it's like the best dark chocolate, my brain gives me this big dopamine spritz. It's like fireworks. It's like, great, this is a great chocolate shop. You should come back here in the future. And so what happens is dopamine specifically fires and says, hey, remember this. It's a learning mechanism. And in these Roscorla-Wagner models, this is called a positive prediction error, meaning not that something went wrong, but it means that it was different than what my brain expected.
It was surprisingly good.
Yes. And you're highlighting the key piece here, surprise. So dopamine fires when we are surprised. Yet, and we can be surprised because something is so salient that we can't not pay attention to it. But if something isn't like, you know, very surprising, as long as we pay attention, we can still get that prediction error. So if it's really good chocolate, I learned this is a good chocolate shop, come back here. If it's not that great, my brain says meh. And that meh in scientific terms is a negative prediction error.
Surprisingly disappointing.
And disappointment is what leads to disenchantment, is what leads to behavior change.
And the release of that craving eventually over time.
Absolutely.
With repetition.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. If I could jump in, there were a couple of paragraphs that were like money paragraphs to me. The light bulb went off in your book. So the paragraphs are, these cravings had nothing for foods. These cravings had nothing to do with what their stomachs were telling them. It's as though the wires connecting their brains to their stomachs had been crossed with their emotional wiring. I had assumed that hunger was clear and obvious when we felt it. I was dead wrong. And for people who have ignored true physical hunger with dieting and restricting for a long time, this disconnect between brain and body can be especially significant, right? So we have this decoupling of broad wanting related to emotional needs that are being unsatisfied, which then gets crossed with hunger and somehow using food as sort of like the medicine, if you will, for a different kind of thing that ails us, right? And so you're helping people become more aware of the crossing of those wires, and you're also attending to the ways in which the typical dieting or typical food restricting processes can lead people almost to dissociate from and to become unaware of and disconnected from actual hunger for food. Right. So I wondered if you could just kind of build on all that and use that as well to lead us into the overarching model of your 21-day program.
I'd be happy to. And this, the context for that paragraph actually came from me doing a group medical visit with people with binge eating disorder. And yet another assumption that I'd had was that they could tell when they were hungry. And the fact was that they couldn't. one person put it very clearly. She said, I have an urge and I eat. And she couldn't actually tell me if that urge was based on what's described as physiologic hunger, which is the normal survival hunger, or what's now a term in science called homeostatic hunger versus hedonic hunger. So the homeostatic hunger is says when I'm out of homeostasis, when I'm out of balance, I need to eat some food to get back into balance. Hedonic hunger is interesting. It's a misnomer because we're not actually hungry. We're eating because of an emotion. That's why they termed it hedonic hunger, but it's not true hunger. And so here the miswiring is where people get an urge to eat, not because they're hungry, but because of an emotion, right? And so this is where this food mood wiring starts to get set up and reinforced.
Could you give an example here, Judd, of how the initial stages of that might come about for a person? In other words, how that initial crossing of the wires might start to form for a person? Just like give an example.
Sure, sure. So from a survival standpoint, you know, brains have to learn where food is. Mm-hmm. And in modern day, it seems trivial because we're like, I know where the fridge is. Food is readily available and we don't have to go and search for it very far. So that survival mechanism is three elements. There are a trigger, a behavior, and a result. And this goes back to our ancient ancestors foraging for food. The trigger is that they see the food, the behaviors, they eat it. And then the result is that their stomach sends this dopamine signal that says, remember what you ate and where you found it or how to get it, basically. So that's the normal survival wiring. So this can happen at first randomly, but it also is set up in our modern day culture because we do so many things socially related to food where we first learn, oh, you know, like we're at a birthday party when we're a kid, for example. Oh, ice cream, cake, you know, games, fun, blah, blah, blah. And we start to associate food with fun, right? And that's this positive reinforcement that starts wiring in food equals fun, not food is consumed when we're hungry. The second piece that often happens less deliberately is when we start to learn, oh, I'm not feeling good. And that negative feeling from a survival standpoint, negative, not good, make this, our brain says, make this go away, do something to make this go away. And so we might either remember, oh, food tastes good, let me eat some food. Or maybe we're sad as a kid and our mom's like, oh, maybe they're hungry and our mom feeds us some food, you know, and accidentally starts to help us set up that food mood relationship that's part of the negative reinforcement process where we learn, oh, I feel sad, angry, frustrated, lonely, bored, whatever. And then I eat food and I feel better. The third piece that can happen here is just the association. And I still remember this, you know, going to the movies. Like when I was a kid, I can still remember the smell of popcorn in the movie theater. It's so distinct, right? That popcorn doesn't necessarily taste good, but man.
Real mixed bag in practice, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was about going to see the movie. It was like this whole thing, going to the movie theater, and it was a big treat to get popcorn. So it didn't matter how bad it was, I was going to eat it. And so we make those associations as well. So, you know, fast forward, no, it doesn't matter how many years, because these can get set up pretty quickly. We start to learn, oh, celebration, eat some food. Oh, feel angry, feel bored, feel sad, eat some food. Or, oh, it's time for the nightly Netflix or television show. Oh, let's have a snack, you know, some popcorn while we do that. And so all these food mood relationships get set up in the absence of hunger. And so that's where those wires get crossed because it's not about survival.
How do we help ourselves not be so manipulated by both the kind of forces outside us and the forces inside us?
The nice thing here is you don't have to have a PhD in neuroscience to understand this. We've covered most of the territory here already even. I think of this as concepts in the service of wisdom. And I want to mention this outright because how many people can look back and one of the people that I interviewed for the book, she had a huge stack of books in her basement all about dieting. So this highlights that concepts aren't enough. So we need to know a little bit of the concept, like we've just been talking about, but immediately translate that into wisdom through this intermediate of experience. And so the first step is really just understanding how this miswiring happens. And we can, you know, we can go as far as mapping out the eating habit loop, but we can actually keep it even very simple and just ask this question: why am I reaching for food? Right? Is it out of hunger or is it out of habit? And that habit could be anything from boredom to sadness to some emotional, you know, non-hunger reason that we've associated with food. And so simply pausing and asking that question brings awareness in and brings some curiosity in, like, huh, why am I reaching for food? Then we can start to, I think of it, there are two next steps here. One is to start to kind of reacquaint and reconnect with our bodies, where we can start to relearn what true physiologic hunger feels like if we have not, if we've not experienced that for a while. And so in the book, there's, and you don't need to read the book to understand this and start practicing it, we can start to look for true hunger signals. So for example, the ones that are non-overlapping tend to be the ones like stomach growling and feeling very empty. The ones that are overlapping with other psychological states include things like irritability. So we could be irritable for a number of reasons, including being hungry. So we can start to, you know, just explore that territory. Ah, why am I reaching for food? Am I actually hungry? And once we kind of reacquaint ourselves with true physiologic hunger and what that feels like, then we can start to shift into the second step, which is to really pay attention as we eat. Okay. But before we go on to that, I just want to pause. Does that make sense? Any questions before we go on?
It makes complete sense. And I find myself could just kind of pop up a little bit to a bird's eye view. So here we are, three men, middle-aged, including Forrest.
Sneaking up
early
on
middle-aged.
I called myself middle-aged in a episode like a year ago. And I got so many comments from people being like, you're not middle-aged yet. And I was like, it's fine. I'm close enough.
I think of myself as in early, late middle age, and I'm holding on to the first word there.
Man, you're stretching here, buddy, but okay.
But in any case, and you know, and we're white, we're privileged, and I just think about so many of the messages that pound on people related to body image, body shape, food, diet, are heavily gendered and also culturally situated in all kinds of ways. And what strikes me a lot about your approach, Judd, in a great way, you're really about freedom. You're really about choice. And somehow it reminds me of this personal growth workshop I took in my wild and crazy 20s called Freedom Eating, where for 16 weeks, we would do some bizarre thing related to food and was basically about disrupting our relationship to food and through bringing tremendous amount of awareness into what we were doing and why and what was actually enjoyable, what was not really promotive of well-being and so forth. So freedom, that's what we're really trying to bring in. And so I just kind of wonder maybe if it's appropriate to tap the brakes just a smidge for a second here and pop up to this higher level of recognizing the ways in which this topic is culturally embedded. And I wonder about your reflections about that and how your approach in a way is almost like a kind of a radical orthogonality to the dominant food culture in which you're just coming in from this different approach that's fundamentally about freedom from craving.
Yes. So fundamentally, it is orthogonal, but orthogonal doesn't mean that it sidesteps the issues. And so I'm glad you bring these up because I think it's very important to acknowledge them. And I'll be the first person to say that, you know, when it comes to social determinants of health, whether it's cultural or whether it's privilege or food deserts or all these different determinants that are critical in how we learn to relate to food and how we continue to relate to food, there are many experts out there, and I am not one of them. So I briefly mentioned that these are important in the book, But I'm, you know, there have been plenty of people that have written books and scientific papers about how to address these. And I just want to take a moment to highlight how it is really important that we all advocate for policy change at a governmental level to help change the regulations to really support the social determinants, because that's going to be a critical piece that's going to help us all become happier and healthier at a societal level. The food industry is very well resourced, and people who are affected by the food industry are not very well resourced when it comes to lobbying Congress. And so it's been pretty clear that the food lobby has a heavy influence on all of our health. And if you just look at the trends, they're not moving in the right direction, despite knowing more about what the problem is.
If you're like me, you've probably started to pay closer attention to your long-term health as you've aged. Turning 35 was a bit of a wake-up call for me, and I'm always looking for good sources of information, because it's often really difficult to separate fact from fiction when it comes to our physical health. We had Dr. Tim Spector on the podcast a few years ago. He's a professor of genetic epidemiology and the scientific co-founder at Zoe. And the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast is truly one of the best resources out there when it comes to this stuff. With the help of world-leading scientists, they help you make smarter health choices every week. And you don't have to just take my word for it. Avid podcast fan Stephanie's Apple review says the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast is a life-changing, science-based, myth-busting podcast. That's a must-listen for anyone who eats food and wants to understand how it affects their body. With the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast, you can join Stephanie and millions of others transforming their health. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like being well, I think you'll really enjoy the Dr. John Delaney Show. Dr. John's show was recently in the top 5 of all podcasts on Apple Podcasts, which is just an incredible accomplishment, and it speaks to how much value people get out of the show. Dr. John has a PhD in counseling, and he's been working with people for over 20 years. And the show has a very cool format. Real people call into the show, and he walks them through how to navigate a tough situation related to common challenges. Maybe it's something related to their relationships, anxieties, or emotional well-being. He explores a lot of topics that are similar to what we talk about on this podcast, but while we can sometimes be pretty theoretical in nature, the format of John's show just creates a lot of directness and practicality to it. I think it's actually a really nice complement to what we do here on Being Well. No matter what you're going through, the Dr. John Delaney Show is here for you. And if you ever need some advice, you know who to call. Listen to the Dr. John Delaney Show wherever you get your podcasts, or follow the link on our website. One of the things in the book that kind of speaks to this and speaks to the freedom point that Rick was talking about that I really appreciated was you had, I think it was an example of a person in the book who had a habitual eating pattern related to carrots, if I'm remembering this correctly. And, mm-hmm. you know, as a reader, you go like, that's a first world problem right there. A habitual eating problem related to carrots. Like, what are we doing here? But at the same time, it really, really highlights that the problem that you're working with is the nature of the habit and the nature of the, as you said, I think the word that you used is they were pounding carrots. It's mm-hmm. the pounding that's the problem. It's that habitual craving behavior around whatever it is that, you know, is that person's particular shtick for whatever reason. And what we really want to develop is more freedom of choice in whatever it is that we're doing. Like if we're enjoying something and it's great and it's what you want to be doing in that moment, you know, it's your body. You make your own choices about things. But you want to be at choice inside of this process. And that's the kind of meta commentary that you're doing with the book and with a lot of the way that it's structured inside of the program itself, which is heavily focused on developing an awareness of what's going on. And then as you were saying a second ago, like really reprogramming the reward value of these various things. And I think that this might be a good time to mention the raisin practice from, I think it's MBSR.
Yes, yes. So there are these jokes around, you know, a lot of people that have had access to, you know, meditation retreats, for example, have tended to be, you know, upper middle class. And you've probably heard the joke. It's the upper middle way, you know, kind of this play on the Buddhist, you know, the middle way, and highlighting how, you know, people who are single parents who are working multiple jobs, taking care of, you know, kids, they don't necessarily have the privilege to be able to go on a week-long meditation retreat or take something, even take an MBSR program, for example, that is, you know, set up as multiple hours a week and then an all-day retreat, and to which their bosses say, you can do that and you'll get fired, you know, that type of thing. So this raisin exercise comes about in the first day of these MBSR programs as a way to introduce people basically to paying attention to something that is something that they tend not to pay attention to. And so, you know, the idea, and many people, anybody that's gone through an MBSR program can relate to this, you know, it's like you have people pull out this raisin and imagine you've never seen it before and look at it and, you know, look at the little wrinkles and listen to it and see if it makes a sound and smell it and do all these things where we're spending, you know, depending on how much the teacher draws this out, you could spend 20 minutes, you know, instead of navel gazing, you could raisin gaze, you know, and then you finally eat it. And the idea is just to show how habitual eating is, right? And that's, we all have to eat. So it's a nice entree into paying attention to something that we normally don't pay attention to. And so I jokingly call it the raisin ritual because, you know, it becomes reified, you know, it's like, oh, have you gone through, you know, the raisin exercise, you know, and there are, you know, plenty of jokes about it, you know, when people that have gone through the program. And one thing I wanted to highlight with that is that certainly we could spend 20 minutes, you know, staring and then eating a raisin. But we could also notice what the purpose of that exercise is, which is to simply learn to pay attention where we haven't been paying attention. And so there have become these, you know, kind of these memes or kind of misnomers around mindful eating is that you have to eat slowly, right? And one thing I want to highlight is that as long as we're paying attention, if we don't have the opportunity to eat slowly, then we can still learn just about everything that we need to know. The key is to be breaking that autopilot and truly, you know, observing as we're eating.
Jed, would it work to kind of walk through an extended example concretely? We could use something you've mentioned for yourself, potato chips, Doritos, let's say. And I want to emphasize the framing here, which is wonderful throughout your whole work. It's the opposite of shaming. You're at the other end of the universe from any kind of shaming, any kind of criticality. You're centrally situated in basically pragmatism. What helps, what hurts, what's good for you. So in that frame, if I could kind of summarize what for me was central in the 21-day program, which then gets really elaborated in a very effective way, it's awareness of the initial craving or wanting, which has this quality of insistence to it. Got to have the chips, mm-hmm. right? Awareness of that, lots of awareness on what does it actually feel like to eat the chips? Is it actually that good? And then awareness afterward of what are the effects with a kind of helping of oneself to gradually appreciate what for oneself is, I'm going to use the word, a better way. Mm-hmm. So help us here. Here you are. You're upset about something, let's say. The emotional issues are in play and it arises, want those chips, okay? And there's that quality of insistence and pressure and contraction and self-referencing that are really the hallmarks of this kind of basic drive, problematic wanting. So now start the example. How would you apply your approach to this particular instance?
So I had a patient who came in who was referred to me, I think it was for eating, binge eating. She wanted to bond with her teenage daughter. And so they would watch a television show together every night. And she was in the habit of busting open a new bag of potato chips and eating the entire bag during the television show. And she tried everything. She couldn't break that habit. And so what I had her do, so one, you can see how there's social connection. There's habit going on. Our brains don't like change. So even contemplating changing that habit was scary for her. And so I just want to highlight that, because for anybody that is contemplating change, it's helpful to remember that our brains are wired to look at change as, is this dangerous or is this different? And so asking that simple question, oh, is this dangerous or is this just different, helps us shift from like, oh no, to, oh, okay, this is different. It's probably not dangerous. If I don't eat a whole bag of potato chips, I'll probably still survive the night. So just knowing that that's how our brains are wired can be helpful as a starting point. And so what I had her do was I said, okay, bust open the bag, bond with your daughter, but just pay attention as you eat the potato chips. And then see how many potato chips are enough before your body says, okay, that's, you know, I'm finished. I've had enough. And the way I describe this in the book is I call this the pleasure plateau. The idea there is that our body is going to tell us everything that we need to know about when we've had enough. And especially if we're not hungry, that pleasure plateau is reached pretty quickly, because our brain's like, okay, I've had, you know, I've scratched that itch, I've had enough, and we don't go over that cliff of overindulgence. So I had this person do the simple experiment, basically pay attention as you eat, you know, don't change any other variable. She comes back and is blown away, because she goes, hey doc, guess how many potato chips I ate? And I don't think this is in the book, so you guys might not know. Can you guess?
I mean, did she just keep going? That might have been me. I might have just kept going. So I'm just thinking for myself here.
It was two.
Oh,
two
really?
Potato chips. Yeah.
Wow.
And the key, I don't know what, I didn't ask her what type of potato chips they were, but some of them are so salty.
I was wondering about the salt. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That I can't possibly eat if I'm paying attention. It's like five, and my body's like, dude, salt quotient for the month.
It's quite extraordinary. She has this huge habit. Mm-hmm. It's socially conditioned. There's so much repetition in it. You bring a mindfulness, an awareness, essentially, into it to tune in. So first, she must have also had the capacity to recognize satiation, physiological enoughness in her own body. So that's remarkable. And second, just that recognition alone, for her at least, was enough to override all the other habit momentum. Mm-hmm. Is that unusual? I mean, wow.
Yeah. So it's, I would say two potato chips is a little unusual, but yeah. You know, as a scientist, I wanted to see if this is true.
Well, I want to highlight those two capabilities that she had. She had to be able to have tuned into enoughness in her physiology. And second, that awareness of enoughness in her physiology must have enabled her to just hit a circuit breaker that disrupted the rest of the habit process. So two capabilities that are, of course, trainable and are focused on in your program.
Yes, trainable. And we all have those as long as we can kind of dust them off and start paying attention to them again.
Yeah, and value them.
Yes, yes. And the nice thing is the value is already there, because our body is telling us, hey, this is not good for survival. So it's there. It's just a matter of listening. You know, it's like that red button on the dashboard is like beeping, you know, it's like blinking, and we just haven't, we've been ignoring it. And we're like, oh, that, what's that red button thing? That doesn't look good. You know? So we actually did an experiment where we have this app called Eat Right Now, and we built in a mindful eating exercise that basically simulated this. It did more than simulate it, actually. It had people go through this process in real life. And the question was, how quickly can somebody develop this disenchantment where that reward value drops below zero? And it turned out that it only takes 10 to 15 times of somebody paying attention on average, right? This is across a bunch of people, 10 to 15 times for that reward value to drop below zero. Now, that was surprising to us in two ways. One, and then it made a lot of sense after we found that and then reproduced it. We reproduced this with the community sample of over 1,000 people. And so one, if you think about it from a survival standpoint, our brains have to be, and you've written about this, our brains have to be tremendously neuroplastic to change, because we are constantly in change. In our world is constantly changing. And so we have to adapt quickly to a changing environment or we won't survive. So that same wiring is still at play when it comes to things that aren't as overtly dangerous. So we have to learn quickly. This confirms that we can learn quickly when it comes to overeating.
Right. That's what's remarkable.
Yeah. And it also highlights, you know, to me, I've never had a patient come back and say, you know, when I've had them pay attention when they've smoked or when they've overeaten, where they've never come back and said, you know, thank you. I never realized how great a cigarette tastes or how good it feels to overeat, you know, never. Because they're like, wow, how did I not realize that and notice it earlier? You know, that's the common refrain is, wow, this seems so obvious. I just never noticed it before.
I'm thinking about this from a little bit from my own perspective here, Jed, because I have a little bit of a habitual eating pattern. When I'm done with work, I typically take some time off, do whatever I do, and then I go and I play video games on my computer most of the time, or I watch, you know, a show on my computer. And part of the ritual of that is pouring off some chips into a bowl. And if, you know, I'm really in it, I will go through multiple cycles of pouring off some chips into a bowl. And I was thinking about this process that you go through with people and reflecting on it myself. I would describe myself as having like pretty good mental skills. You know, I've do a podcast like this. I've been really focused on it in my work life for a better part of 6 years. If anyone's going to be able to do this stuff, it's probably me, right? And I was reflecting on like, okay, applying more. Yeah, I do these things sometimes, applying more mindful awareness to it, being more thoughtful about it. Okay. And there's a part of my brain that just doesn't want to do that. I kind of don't want to go through that disenchantment process because I like this behavior. There's a soothing to it. There's an enjoyment to it. Now, I'm at the very minor side of the consequence spectrum is part of the reason that there's not a lot of incentive to me to change the behavior. But just in general, I'm curious about this kind of like, I don't want to do that. Sure, I can apply mindfulness. I can apply these tools you're teaching, but I don't know if I want to, man. And I'm wondering, for starters, is that just me or is this something that you bump into? And if it's not just me, what do you think about it?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So first off, it's not just you. I see this all the time. And you're highlighting, you know, if you think of the far end of the spectrum of habits, you know, addictions, you know, where people often talk about having to hit rock bottom before mm-hmm. they change. And so you're highlighting kind of that middle road where it's like, oh, it's not bad enough that my body says, hey, this is bad. You know, you got to do something about this. And many of us are living in that territory all the time, every day. So the way I think about that is that there are two levers that we can pull on when it comes to changing behavior. One is focusing in on how unrewarding the current habit is, right? And that helps us become disenchanted with it simply by paying attention. So let's start there and then we'll play with the other lever. So let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. If you simulate or think back to the last time you did that, mm-hmm. why not just eat more? Why not keep going even more than you do?
I think it's two things. First, it's driven by some other values that I have. Mm-hmm. I am at least somewhat appearance conscious. I do have some of those models that we were talking about that are socially derived about like how I look and how I feel. So that's definitely in the mix. Secondarily, I think kind of more to the point, I get full. My body gets done. It stops being an enjoyable activity. I've hit that pleasure plateau and I'm starting to fall off the edge of it. Yeah, I would say that's mostly why.
Okay, great. So you're highlighting, if I'm hearing what you're saying correctly, one, there might be some hunger in there.
Yeah, there could be, yeah.
Okay, and if there's not, my guess is you get full more quickly. Like some days you might be hungrier than others. I'm just guessing. And that's something that you could explore. So when there's hunger involved, it might be crossing with our normal survival mechanisms that say, hey, this is, you know, I don't want to stop doing this because this is getting calories in and, you know, it's helping me in that sense. So you could play with, you know, exploring that even more when you're not hungry and see how quickly you hit that plateau. Mm-hmm. And so that can build the disenchantment. So the other lever that you can press is to ask and this is the kind of the last part of the program, is finding what I call that bigger, better offer. So let me ask this. Have you ever had any other type of food in the bowl besides potato chips, or is it just your ritual?
Chips are the go-to. If we have like berries around the house, I sometimes use berries too, like blueberries is my typical one. I think they actually came up for you in the book as well, which I thought was funny. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but yeah, that's one that I'll sometimes go to as well. It has to be like a good pint of blueberries though. You know, blueberries, there's a spectrum, some not so great, some fantastic. So
just as an aside, blueberries are interesting because I just realized this recently. They can provide intermittent reinforcement because you never know with each blueberry how sweet or how tart it's going to be.
That's a very funny point. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, blueberries are great because they taste great, you know, and I don't down pint after pint. My body's like, okay, it's full, you know, good enough, save the rest for later. So the thing you're highlighting there, and this is the second lever that we can pull, is we can compare, well, what's it like to fill up on potato chips? Whatever that bowl is, it could be filled with chips or it could be filled with blueberries. And then we can ask afterwards, what did I get from this? Right? Where do I feel more content? Hmm. And in the moment, and then also we can look 10 minutes later, 20 minutes later, an hour later, to see how it affects our energy level, our mood, all of those things afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if you've had a chance to do that exploration. And if you have, I'd be curious to hear.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think this really connects to something that Rick and I actually recently did an episode of the podcast on, which is the distinction between liking and wanting that you talk about in your work all the time. A lot of the time when we're in an experience that we have a habit pattern around, or maybe even a discrete want in the mind for, a lot of the time when I'm doing this, I'm like barely conscious. So it's not even that I want it. This is just the pattern. It's the thing that I do. But even when we're activated into it and there's a lot of wanting, there might not actually be a lot of discrete liking or enjoyment. And so part of what you're doing here is like you're helping people sort of focus on that enjoyment aspect. So for me with the blueberries, yeah, I can actually really kind of feel into how that would be a more enjoyable experience for me in some ways than my habitual pattern with like a slightly less healthy food, or in some cases, a much less healthy food. And how like with the reflection, you know, from the third eye on this whole thing, hey, if it's a more enjoyable experience, why don't you do, and it also has all these like secondary gains for you in terms of, you know, health and wellness and all of that. Why not just do that one instead? And sometimes I can't answer that question very well. It's funny how that works, where it seems so obvious, and at the same time, it's hard to actually activate into.
And that often hints at one thing, which is, and maybe I'm biased as a scientist, but it says, hey, collect more data, right? And one thing to do, you know, your mission should you choose to accept it, is you mentioned I'm hardly conscious when I'm doing this. And so you can just even bring awareness, even a few moments, you know, pause the video game, whatever, and notice what it's like. What does your body feel like? What's it taste like? And then, you know, you could even have the bowl of chips and have the bowl of blueberries, and you can compare them side by side if you really want to do that, you know, do the experiment.
I love a little A-B testing here, Jeff. Yeah, this is great. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. You can't do it blinded, obviously, because you know what they taste like, but you get the idea, right? You can do the direct comparison.
Yeah.
And I would be very curious to see how little awareness you need to actually flip that switch from one habit to the other.
So for me, I have functional hunger cues. I can basically tell when I'm full on whatever it is I'm full on, chips, blueberries, something else entirely. But a lot of the people that you work with, as you were saying early on, do not have functional hunger cues. Those hunger cues have been disabled either due to the kind of cross-wiring that we were talking about earlier with some emotional stuff, or frankly, because of over-restriction and over-control and just general fixation on these kinds of food issues that they've had. So they've just like learned to stop trusting themselves. One of the hardest things that I found for people to develop is interoception, just being able to like actually feel into their body and get a sense of what's going on in there. And I'm wondering if there are particular tools that you've found in doing this work that have been really helpful for people.
That's a really good question. I'm so glad you're asking that. So the first tool I would say is actually kindness. And the reason you both are nodding, because I'm sure you can see where I'm going with this. Without kindness, we're often playing this script of self-judgment in the background. And that self-judgment script divorces us from ourselves. So that we're, you know, as I love the James Joyce short story, it's called The Painful Case, where he says, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. And so when we're playing the self-judgment story or the script, we're often living at short distance from our body because we're not comfortable in our own skin, literally. Mm. And so the idea is to open that door and come home to ourselves and re-inhabit our bodies, reconnect with ourselves. And that all starts with, you know, kindness is the key to unlock that door. And so even just noticing what it feels like when we judge ourselves and comparing that to what it's like when we're kind to ourselves or when somebody else is kind to us, if we can't remember what it's like to be kind to ourselves, that's the key that opens the door. Once we do that, that's where we can start to get curious. And so I think of kindness and curiosity as best friends. Kindness, if we're good at self-judgment, then kindness is the first step. And then kindness brings along curiosity as a friend. If we tend not to run that script as much, curiosity can lead the way and kindness is not far behind. But those two work very, very well together. So kindness for most of us is a really good place to start, just being kind to ourselves, right? And just seeing where we've got the story of I'm not good enough or shame or whatever it is. And then, you know, just doing some practices to help support ourselves. And I'm sure you guys have done tons of podcasts on different ways that people can support themselves. So I would say listen to all those podcasts over again. So once we've got kindness, you know, as our companion, then we can start to get curious and start asking simple questions like, huh, what does hunger feel like? Right. And we can even do some experiments where we're like, well, okay, I haven't eaten in a little while. Let me check in with my body and see if I'm hungry. Okay, let's go a little bit longer and then kind of wait for our bodies to tell us what hunger feels like. And then we can say, okay, there's this, you know, that seems familiar again. And other ways that we can support that is doing simple practices like the body scan, just to practice re-inhabiting our bodies. Like you're saying, the interoceptive awareness is often very foreign to us because we live so much of the time in our heads. And so this is where just remembering that the feeling body is much wiser and stronger than the thinking brain, that's where all the action is. And so reacquainting, refamiliarizing, and reconnecting with our bodies is really essential for this whole process.
I've long had a deep interest in craving broadly and kind of rooted in the Buddha's drive theory of suffering and that fundamental tipping point, because life is not inherently suffering. It's just when we bring the understandable, it's not our fault that we have this profound machinery of craving inside us, but it is our responsibility as to how we relate to it and what we do about it. And so when I think about my own versions of practicing, kind of in the three-step process is how I think of it that you're describing. Step one is awareness of wanting, that intensity, and is to step back from it, first of all, rather than be identified with it. And to step back, and in the stepping back, we basically are saying, you're not driving me in this instant. You know, I'm observing you. And then what is that intensity of wanting about? And to pull apart the threads of it, oh, there's an insistent element. Oh, there's a kind of contraction. Oh, there's a sense of something missing, something wrong, you know, some drive I need to fulfill here. Also, I think of it as these intensities of prediction, you know, deep down in the motivational machinery, you know, subcortically and so on. In our brain is this ancient advertising agency, you know, as well as alarmist agency that's over-predicting benefits and over-predicting harms depending on what it's doing. And very often, it's neither so great nor so horrible as that machinery is predicting, you know, to motivate the little monkey or rat or lizard deep inside us all. Okay, all that's going on. So there's this deconstructing of awareness. And what helps me alongside that kind of awareness, that deconstructing, teasing apart awareness of wanting itself and the body sensations of it, is this little voice, you know, Rick, you're okay already. Rick, you're all right already, which is kind of bringing in a quality of contentment, which tends to defuel that intensity of craving. So that's like part one. And then part two, just like you're saying, noticing that, you know, the promised rewards are not that great. But the second potato chip, I'm kind of okay. That's the second part. And for me, there's something about that that's wonderful. It's like, as you say, waking up from the spell in that second step where you realize, wow, they've been tricking me, right? Or deep inside, you know, that ancient circuitry has been tricking me and I don't want to be bossed around by it. And then that third stage, I'm so interested in that third stage of inclining the mind in that language of helping ourselves learn to want what's better for us, the bigger, better offer. I like that BBO, right? Maybe you could talk a little more about that because we've sort of under-discussed that so far here. How do we help ourselves start to really like that other way? And one little trick I use for myself is to think about the me I will be becoming, the guy who will be suffering, you know, the long-term pain after that short-term gain. And, you know, kind of appreciating what will be good for that guy, as it were. So I'm increasingly inclined in that direction. How do you help people do that third part?
That's a really good question. If we could just take a minute and go back to the first part, I just want to highlight something that's interesting. You know, the contentment often indicates balance. And when we're physiologically out of balance, you know, homeostatic hunger is a great example of where there's a natural drive to eat. And so I just want to highlight, and I think this is what you're saying as well, but I just want to be very clear here. We can have a craving for food because we're hungry. And that is not caught in the cycle of suffering, right? In fact, it's helpful. It says, hey, go eat some food to get back in balance. So, and that contentment is the signal that we're back in balance. I think if I'm hearing what you're saying, one thing you're highlighting here is that when we have this story, when it's that hedonic or emotional hunger or this story around hunger, we're out of balance and we're not going to actually get back into balance because we're actually making ourselves more out of balance by feeding that, scratching that itch and feeding that craving. So I just want to, is that in line with what you're saying?
Yeah. I think of auto craving, auto wanting, you know, the brain is sort of looking for something to want. And then also there's sort of like delusional insufficiency. And what I mean by that is that, you know, drives come from a sense of needs unmet, you know, something missing, something wrong. So in my own little practice with myself, there's both a lot of granular awareness of wanting, craving, and so forth. And also an awareness that it comes from a sense of something missing, something wrong, that's not actually true in the present. In the present, I'm not starving. In the present, I'm basically okay. So much is okay. So I'm essentially associating, I'm counterconditioning a sense of fullness and balance and contentment to a sense of something missing, something wrong, craving, to gradually defuel, you know, the fires of craving.
So this actually does point toward the question that you were asking is how do we, you know, how do we find this third step more easily and how do we condition this? So you're highlighting this very powerful element of awareness. If we can start to see what is knocking us off balance, and if we are knocking ourselves off balance, that's very different than our physiologic hunger saying, hey, I'm truly out of balance. And so if we can see clearly what it is, then instead of trying to, you know, we could try to steer ourselves back on track, but that tends to take this, oh, my future self type of thing. Or we could ask, what if I stop steering myself off track. And then we naturally get back into balance. And so here, you know, I'm thinking about the, you know, if we're eating because of an emotion, right? If it's a hedonic hunger, then we can ask ourselves, you know, one, what does eating my mood actually get me? Where we become disenchanted with it. We've talked about that. So that can help us become less excited about continuing to steer ourselves off track. But on top of that, we can ask the simple question, what do I actually need? What do I actually need? And in that way, we don't have to even look at our future self, because it's hard to look into the future, right? There's this whole delay discounting science showing that the farther we look out in the future, the harder it is to actually aim toward those goals, because our brain says, I don't know if I'm going to be alive then, but I'm alive right now. So I'm going to take this immediate reward over something possible in the future. So it's really hard for us to incline ourselves cognitively toward a future reward. That's just how our brains are set up. So knowing that, we can say, okay, forget about the future stuff because it's just not that powerful. Let's look at the immediate stuff. And we can ask, okay, what do I need? And what's it like to meet a need as compared to feed a want? Which one feels better right now? Concrete example, right? Let's say that we're lonely or we're bored and we eat the chips or the whatever the comfort food is. We can ask ourselves, feeding that want, what did I get from that? Versus if I actually meet this need in a way that truly meets it, which one is more rewarding? And I'll hand that to you all. Like, how does that, you know, do that simulation and see if that actually, does that get at the question that you're asking?
As per the usual, there's just like so much here that we could talk about and keep going with and keep exploring. I really appreciate that you're making this very immediate, Jed. Over time, I've gotten better at inclining toward that kind of future self ideology, you know, the person that I will become, the person I'm living into. Dad, I know that that's like very rich for you and your experience, even frankly, as somebody who's in their 70s, you're still very into the person that you're becoming, which I think is like a real testament to you in some ways and like a very beautiful part of your personality. And also, man, the immediacy of all of this is so real. And so the more and more that like, as you're going through this process, if you are somebody who struggles with these kinds of issues, who struggles with these habitual patterns, whatever they're related to, including possibly food, being able to find bigger, better offers that are in the here and now, I think is just a huge part of the process. Whether those are emotional, bigger, better offers, or they're behavioral or even like physical, bigger, better offers, whatever it is that does it for you, that's just such a huge part of the process. And it's really okay. Like, it's okay to do something else that maybe you think of as like, oh, is this a, am I getting myself into some other bad habit here? It's like, oh, you can kind of run the internal calculus on that a little bit and be like, for me, for example, if it helps me to like play a different game or something, great, go do that. It's all right. You're working inside of one habitual structure, and that's not always the easiest thing in the world. Do you think that's a fair way to put part of what you're saying here, Jed?
Absolutely. And I love giving ourselves leeway to experiment, because we can learn from everything that we do. And so when you say, oh, let me try this, and we can see what happens. We can see how it plays out. We can collect the data and say, oh, that didn't work so well. You know, what can I learn from this? And so we can learn as long as we are open to learning. And so life becomes this journey of discovery as compared to, you know, some list of things that we have to try to follow that we will invariably, you know, falter with because it's somebody telling us what to do.
Well, Jed, thanks so much for doing this.
This is great. And if I could, I just want to note a postscript, as it were. Yeah, this thing about affective forecasting and our sense of kindness, even duty to our future self, as it were. And what I notice for at least myself, if I imagine doing something today that will hurt Forrest tomorrow or help Forrest tomorrow, I'm highly motivated to do that thing today or avoid the thing today, you know, for his welfare. It's just very straightforward. It's salient. It's immediate. Mm-hmm. You know, it's strong, actually. Like, don't mess up. You know, it's there, or do the right thing. But on the other hand, that future Rick, that guy hopefully is going to be here in 24 hours. Meh. Like what? What is that?
What's up
that
with that?
Makes yeah. it so yeah. easy for us to be fairly easily motivated, often toward, you know, those we care about and their welfare and what would be best for them net net, including in ways that have some cost to us in the present, and yet not have that be so motivationally salient and influential for us when it's applied to the one we will be, even though we will most inhabit the one we will be more than we'll inhabit the life of the other person, the mindset of the other person. And we have the greatest influence, therefore the greatest moral responsibility, right, to the one we will be.
Yeah. What a great question. I think this can be a ... to be continued.
Okay.
Because okay. I don't have a pithy answer to that.
Yeah.
You know, I think some of it relates to how we discount ourselves, and we, you know, often just even subconsciously where, you know, this, we think, oh, I'm going to be here tomorrow. And so we may not be as salient to ourselves as our loved ones. And we're also kind of creating this, you know, this duality where it's, we're not looking at ourselves as part of the picture as much as looking at others as an important part of the picture. And so, you know, weighting ourselves in terms of what is more important, where, you know, you might weight Forrest more than yourself. And so certainly there can be some biological drives for that, for sure. And there can also be, you know, we can be exploring, well, my future self might actually be just as important to help Forrest as my current self. So what, you know, or making this decision now. So what is it that I am ignoring or assuming that is contributing to that differential? Super interesting question.
Oh, yeah. It's so interesting, isn't it? Even given the degree to which self-referencing is so intensively developed in us, and yet still, when it comes to motivation for the welfare of a future being, other beings typically are much more salient to us than our own welfare. So for me, the takeaway pragmatically is to do operant conditioning a lot about how I want to incline my mind. I'm really kind of marinating in the sense of how good it will be for that future Rick, you know, later in the evening or tomorrow to have, you know, conducted myself in some ways that are better for me and so on. So that I really start to associate that bigger, better offer highly, you know, to what I can do in the present.
Love it.
Jed, you've been incredibly generous with your time as per the usual. So thanks so much for doing this with us.
My pleasure. This has been really fun.
I really enjoyed our conversation today with Dr. Jed Brewer, in part because of the overall tone of it. This was not a conversation about diets or about weight loss or really about nutrition. It was about changing the relationship that we have with our habitual patterns and applying that broad notion of being at choice about our behavior to a particular kind of substance that people often struggle with, namely food. And you could apply the lessons from today's conversation to really any habitual pattern, particularly any habitual pattern that has an emotional aspect to it, and different behaviors that we use as emotional coping mechanisms. So there might be something here for people who struggle with smoking or alcohol. I think there are also lessons here, frankly, for our interpersonal relationships and the habits of interaction that we get sucked into in order to soothe ourselves in different ways. I have plenty of little ways that I cope emotionally sometimes by pushing other people away or by forcing environments to be exactly the way that I want them to be, and not being sufficiently sensitive to the needs of other people. And these are all habitual patterns of different kinds. But the key tools that Jed focuses on here, awareness, being just conscious of what's going on while it's happening, then that basic notion of updating the reward value of an experience where as you're applying awareness, you're being with whatever it is that you're doing. So you're seeing it for what it is, as opposed to seeing it for the story that the brain is telling you about what it is. And then finally, finding that bigger, better offer. What's something that would actually be more appealing, more enjoyable in the moment than whatever it is that your brain is currently stuck on. The key target that we're aiming for here, whether it's our relationship with food or with alcohol or with interpersonal behaviors or with the way that we work with our own mind or whatever else, the key goal is freedom. That's what we're aiming for here. We want to be at choice about our behaviors as opposed to being trapped in a prison of repetition. And I loved some of the things that we talked about toward the end of the conversation, and particularly how Judd really emphasized the role of kindness and self-compassion here as key values, not just because we're all being kind of, ooh, warm and fuzzy with ourselves or some of that, you know, new age BS, but because actually, truly, these are behavioral change mechanisms. They feel good. They support you in building new and more useful habits. And then alongside that, how guilt and shame and issues around self-worth are huge impediments in this process. How when we have that judgmental voice inside of ourselves, it takes us away from the active participation with our body, from the active participation with our ongoing moment-to-moment experience that is the key intervention here that he highlights that helps us update the reward value of behaviors so that we can actually see how these habitual patterns are not benefiting us in the way that we want them to. We laid the foundation for this early in the conversation by talking about diets and willpower and many of just the misunderstandings that people have and the mistakes that they make, frankly, when having these kinds of conversations about food-related issues. For many people, the advice is follow this diet and apply your willpower. The problem here is that our behavior is based on systems of reward that are set up in the brain, not based on our ability to apply willpower over a long period of time. But diets typically focus on the willpower side of the spectrum rather than the reward value manipulation side of the spectrum. And that's just the wrong way to do it. Studies on willpower have found, and this is quoting from Judd's book, people who exerted more self-control were not actually more successful in accomplishing their goals. The more effort they put in, the more depleted and exhausted they felt. What we resist persists. And as that resistance energy just builds up and builds up and builds up inside of ourselves, it eventually becomes overwhelming. And there's something actually in addiction psychiatry that's called the abstinence violation effect. And this is just an observed feature where when people fall off the wagon finally because they just can't apply willpower anymore, they don't just fall off the wagon a little bit, they fall off the wagon totally and completely. And then diets and other forms of highly restricted approaches to eating tend to actually make matters worse by separating people from their natural feelings, from the natural hunger cues that they have inside of their own body. And chronic dieting can actually create and later trigger eating disorders for at-risk individuals. A key part of this is understanding that for many people with disordered eating, they have lost touch with their natural hunger cues. And the cue to eat has just become craving of any kind. But our hunger cravings and our emotional cravings, these are problems that have different kinds of actual solutions. We solve a hunger issue by eating, but we can't solve an emotional issue by eating food. So what is Judd doing that's different from the typical restrictive willpower-driven model? Well, first he starts with people's actual problem here, which is often that they don't have a good feel for their own natural hunger cues. We talked in some detail about how we can improve interoception and get back in touch with those natural hunger cues, including by paying attention to ourselves as we move through the day, operating with more kindness and self-compassion, and maybe even applying basic mindfulness techniques like a body scan meditation. So then we get to the really practical stuff. How do we actually change a habit loop? And the key way to do it is by creating what's called a prediction error. Really notice, is this enjoyable? Is this not enjoyable? When does it stop being enjoyable? How long is it enjoyable for? After I do the thing, how do I feel? A lot of the time we can feel like we're basically sleepwalking through life. And this was my example with the chips in the bowl where when I'm, you know, watching a movie or a TV show or playing some video games at the end of the day, it becomes a sleepwalking behavior. Again, I'm not at choice. And by bringing this awareness to it, I can start to notice when am I actually full? When am I content? When am I done here? What else would be more enjoyable for me, actually authentically, than the behavior that I'm habitually doing right now? And going through that process, developing some awareness of our interior, getting back in touch with what the body is telling us, having a granular noticing of the moment-to-moment enjoyment or not enjoyment that's associated with a given activity, just that alone is often enough to really help people here. And then alongside that, we build up that bigger, better offer, that thing that would actually be more enjoyable than whatever the habitual pattern is, the incentive to the brain that talks it into trying something else on. And this might be a little edgy for people, but for me, a bigger, better offer is often feeling emotionally good about myself, feeling like I put the effort in, feeling like I was aligned with a sense of meaning and purpose in whatever it is that I'm doing. Feeling, as Rick said toward the end of the conversation, like I'm really helping out that person that I am becoming. Those emotional feelings are often a bigger, better offer for us. But to get to them, we have to work through the shame, the self-criticism. And so the first step is often building in a little space around that suffering. And when we can offer that to ourselves, it is really a fantastic first step here in changing any kind of habitual behavior. So I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Our guest today was Dr. Judd Brewer. His recent book was The Hunger Habit. It is a fantastic book. I think it is one of the absolute best ones that has been written on these topics. If you'd like to support the show, the best way to do that is by subscribing wherever you're listening to this now. We really appreciate that. It turns out also if you're watching on YouTube that only about a quarter of the people who watch these videos are subscribed to the channel. So if you could please subscribe, that would be great. If you'd like to support my work in other ways, you can find me on Substack and on Patreon at patreon.com/beingwellpodcast. I've had a lot of fun writing for Substack recently. I'd really appreciate it if you would check that out. Until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.